hearing by phone, and she and Megan Schultz are on the phone today. I'm just going to try to keep us on track with the agenda. So maybe let's go around the room, though, and everybody say their names so we know who's here, and then we'll get started. And we can start down at that end.
So it's Joanne Southey from Department of Justice.
Aaron Knott from the Attorney General's Office.
Gail Meyer from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm a voyeur today.
Nancy Cozine, Office of Public Defense Services.
Lois Day, Child Welfare, DHS.
Valerie Loveland, County Circuit Court.
Leola McKenzie, Juvenile Court Programs at the Judicial Department.
Anna Noel, Judiciary Committee, in for Bill Taylor.
Betsy Welch, retired circuit judge.
Lori Fellows, Multnomah County DA's office.
Amy Miller, Office of Public Defense Services. I'm also here to watch today.
But not for you.
All right, does everybody still have the task force charge handy with all of their documents? We made some copies in case we needed to have a refresher on that. I see hands going up, so. Maybe we can just kind of go back through and make sure that we're on track and we're not missing anything that we should have been doing during the course of these meetings, and then we can get to reviewing the best practices commitments and the draft legislation, and I think we'll still have some more discussion on that. So thoughts on our charge, and then Megan, do you have that handy, and Judge Sullivan?
I
pulled that. I think it was from last year's November meeting that I had the PowerPoint from Michael.
Also in charge was to report back to the legislature.
And I think we still have to come up with that report, and that was going to be a question, because we went through all those steps with all the charts and coming up with thoughts and recommendations, but we haven't started really any sort of report yet. We have this best practices document we're working on, but not any sort of narrative report, which is also where I thought we're supposed to end up. But I think today, sorting through whether there's a, you know, any point that we need to kind of take another look at or reevaluate or that we missed before I think that draft starts. Judge Sullivan, is that your recollection?
Yeah.
Okay. So, besides that, any concerns, any thoughts, other than that we've got this report that we still need to start? Very silent.
Well, I'll just share, because why shall we sit here in silence? But you all will note you don't have a best practices from me. And here's sort of my thought process as I went through that. There was a proposed best practice that was, I think, designed around the way some courts work, but not all courts in Oregon. And really, the best practice is that caseworkers be able to be caseworkers. I went online and looked at the Child Welfare League of America best practices recommendations. They don't have one for workers in court, except as pertains to being witnesses. Because I think the best practice is that caseworkers be caseworkers and that there's adequate representation to allow that to occur. With that in mind, my goal was to have us settle on the best practices for courts in the CRB, and that from that I would produce the best practices for how child welfare within that context in Oregon courts and CRB, what the best practices would be for us in interacting there. So that was my thought process, and it evolved over time, and it's why you don't have a best practice document that's updated from me. If we settle, and this is it, on these best practices, it will be very quick for me to have a best practices for child welfare workers. I did, though, just so people knew, because training was a part of that and some individual trainings were listed on that draft document, I brought the training matrix for child welfare to share with everyone. I gave it to Mike today to put on the web. But if people are interested in seeing what the trainings we have are, I have this document for you to review.
Okay, anybody else have any thoughts?
I'd like to say something to Lois. It seems to me that some of the things that were in that draft, which was a mishmash, I mean, it was definitely a mishmash of various things that, you know, early, that were collected early on, but the notion that DHS workers would come to settlement conferences with pretty clear written statements that were shared with the parties about what the agency wanted to accomplish and what its plan was for the family, you know, is pretty fundamental stuff. Now, I don't know that much about what's happening in every, you know, in every jurisdiction of the state to know how far from that the reality is, but it's in the places I do know, it's pretty far from reality, and variable with the caseworker. I sympathize with your earlier statement very much. But
so, just a little reflection on that, Judge Welch. I agree that the department needs to come to settlement conferences with clear documentation and outline of where the department believes we need to go in order to resolve the issues that are challenging the family. I think it is not best practice to come into a settlement conference pre-jurisdiction with letters of expectation. I think that, you know, we have an engagement model. The parent's not obligated in any way to work with us prior to jurisdiction, and it to come in having already produced a letter of expectation means we've tried to work with them and it couldn't work. And so that was premature and wouldn't be best practices. So that's why I was sort of pushing back a little on that. Absolutely, we should come with what the department's position is and what we think needs to happen to resolve it. There was another piece on that, discovery at least 3 hours prior to the hearing. I need the courts to settle on when they're going to appoint, because really we need to produce discovery as soon as appointment occurs. And if it's 3 hours ahead of the hearing, great. If it's at the hearing, that's when we can produce it. And so that's why I kept going back and forth around how would I document this. If we settle on this, then I think it's really easy for me to document how the department will function within what the courts have identified as the best practice in Oregon.
Then I wonder if we should just go through the best practices document, because that seems like it's where the discussion is, and then we can kind of come back to making sure we're not missing any steps. Does that sound like it'll work? Okay.
I'm curious. I thought we were going to have legislators here for this meeting.
Weren't we? I think it's the next meeting. Is that correct?
We had originally talked about having Justice Brewer here and some legislators here, and Nancy and I had a conversation that we didn't think the materials were far enough along yet that maybe we should move that to the next meeting. And that was a late conversation, but it was just kind of a
well, I mean, there's an elephant in the room, which is that there's been a rather dramatic change, I think, in the legislature with regard to who's filling what roles, and Bill Taylor has been really active in this group, and he is not available right now, and I think that is
very much playing catch-up on this, so if I've dropped the ball in getting the members here, I apologize.
No, I'm not.
Please send me direction, right, and I will do my best to make it happen.
I'm not implying that at all. I just think that the role that Bill was playing in the conversation was very much the connection to the legislature, and so it's good to take a pause until we have more information about Bill's availability. So I think he was very involved in this conversation, and he can't be right now. So.
Well, and because of that, I did contact Justice Brewer yesterday and let him know that since there weren't going to be legislators here, that maybe he should come at the next meeting when we would hope to have some.
Any other questions before we start looking at the best practices document then? I have the one, I'm looking at the one from that Judge Welch had put together, and then did everybody get a copy of the new modified one that the courts and CRB best practices that was sent out? So,
right here.
Does anybody need that?
There's a few copies here.
There's some more copies. Need one?
Okay, so following the last meeting, we took the documents that were compiled by Judge Welch and put them together, and Judge Love and I kind of went through and said to the things that are legal requirements, these shouldn't be in a best practice document, they're legal requirements. And then we looked at, we had about 9 topic areas, and we gave them to the judges who were at the conference in August, and we asked them to identify for each topic which are the things that they're already doing in court right now, and if they, what are the top 2 or 3 things that they would say should be statewide best practices for the courts. And from that list of 9 topics, we pulled out the top 5 bulleted items, and those are the things at the top of the list there under basic principles. The CRB met in July, and we did the same sort of thing with the CRB and came up with the top 3 things that are identified there. And then the training and oversight and court administration pieces were pieces that really came directly over from the compiled document.
I had a comment on the timeline for the either under the last basic principle, how it says a review every 90 days by either the court or CRB. I think that would be quite a change for some counties. Other counties have a lot of mm-hmm. hearings, and I think we've talked about this before. It's kind of like what is the role of the court in moving cases along? And I think sometimes there's the feeling that maybe parties aren't doing what they're doing, parents or DHS or whoever, so let's get another court hearing and have everyone in to move the case along. So it would just be maybe taking a look at that, if that's really considered the model to get to, because I think typically after, so your 6-month CRB, there isn't another requirement, right, until your next court hearing, which would be your perm hearing. So under this model, you're saying every 90 days, the workers have to be in court or at the CRB. So I don't know, Lois, if you've looked at that or have a thought about it, but it would be a change.
Yeah, no, I looked at that, and I think that, I thought about it a lot. When we have a case that has the court involved, it's important that we involve the court. And so it will be a significant change. It will be it's an obvious increase in resource for everybody if that's the standard. But I do think it's a good practice to keep the court or the CRB regularly apprised of where the case is going. If we're successful in our efforts in the child welfare system around our safe reduction, the cases that remain in foster care in our court cases are going to need the attention of everyone involved. So I think how the court system divides between CRB and actual court hearings is also going to be important, and it varies around the state, but that's, I don't have an objection to every 90 days, especially if that will keep the court involved and or the CRB and move the process.
I was just thinking, like Lane, for example. I mean, that would be a huge change for the docket in Lane.
It would, except we're doing it on some cases now anyway that actually need, either you're trying to get a service in place or encourage a parent. There's something that you, with a six-month window, you can miss that ends up causing a really long delay. And so then if we're looking at, you know, trying to not have kids in substitute care as long and reuniting families and just having the right things happen that we're all trying to work towards, sometimes a court hearing manages to prompt action in some fashion usually. And if it's not going right, you don't have a child having delay that they don't need to have. So, no, I don't know how we do it every 90 days.
Remember, too, this is worded so that it accommodates our practice here. We do a review, but they're not all hearings. We call them paper reviews. Basically, the agency sends in the court report, and then if anybody wants a hearing, we go forward and have one. And then other matters is that you're hearing automatically. So some we're having a hearing every 90 days, and or 90 days, and then CRB, and then 90, and whatever. And then other cases, they're sending in a report. And what we did that for is because we didn't have the docket time to do a 90-day hearing on every single case. And the ones that people are moving along, doing what they need to do, then we're not bringing them in for court. If there's problems in that, then we're bringing them in, or if the judge has set it for an actual hearing in 90 days, then they come in. And that's actually working really well for us. And we had a long discussion at our JSIP meeting yesterday about it, because I know it had been raised in the committee, and the general consensus was that everybody really likes this practice here, because it's enabled us to focus in our scarce docket time on the cases that need it, but that everybody to stay up to speed on what's going on by getting a report every 90 days on every case.
The only other, I think, consideration in that is how cases that have to be heard are docketed. And so for me, it's just a point of concern, because some courts docket specific times, workers know when to show up, etc. Other courts docket everyone at the same time, and there's a long wait. And if you have a case that has hearings every 90 days, that's a significant amount of time in that docketing structure. Mm-hmm. So I just really hope that we get to a place where courts can docket with more specificity to the case they need to hear.
I think the concept of something every 90 days, though, is not a bad one, and that can take a lot of forms. And on occasion, I've asked, you know, let me know with just a letter how something is going. If there's a particular issue with a family or a child that we're all worried about that needs some action, doesn't have to be the full long report, but perhaps just a letter addressing an issue. Then you kind of, I think it prompts more communication among everybody, which is also something that I think is beneficial in the big picture for families. So there's no way our county, I think, could physically do this in the true sense of the word, but if you can kind of, I think as a best practice is to keep everybody on track every 90 days is important, and I think that's a good best practice to aim for, some sort of look.
Well, I'm curious that I don't have the original, but I remember most of it, I think. There's no reference to setting hearings while the parties and counsel are present in court. I don't think that necessarily has to contradict what Judge Sullivan was saying, but if there's going to be a hearing, that it be set in that way, it seems to me ought to be in this best practices document. It's extremely, I mean, the difference it made when we started doing that years ago was monumental in terms of preventing conflicts.
It is in the last one.
Is
not in the newest one, but the one from last time that we moved from. So I think that
and, probably. And, you know, I still think the best practice would be to have a hearing every 90 days on it. We have the resources to do it because it does really help to see everybody. And so, you know, I don't have any problem with that, the goal to aspire to. But the way this is worded, at least that flexibility, if you can't at least do something in the 90 days.
I think that's some of the original concern that CASAS had when this bill came forward was the timeliness of hearings and how do we keep everything moving forward within the system so that we do not have further delays. And particularly, I would say that six-month CRB is really timely because you've had an adjudication hearing or other hearings in between, typically, in that first 6 months. But after that, you don't. And there's often things that when we get to that permanency hearing phase that could have occurred somewhere in that 6 months that didn't, and then we have to have another hearing in 60 days or another hearing in 30 days or the permanency hearing is continued. And oftentimes, in my experience, those things could have been resolved if there had been a 90-day hearing after that six-month CRB. And so as a best practice, I absolutely agree with it. Of course, there are other challenges with docket time and some things that maybe that can be done in each county, particularly if judges have vetted this document and they felt that was also an important component to best practice. So I think it's very valuable, and I appreciate that it's in here.
When we discussed it yesterday, too, everybody decided that the person who'd ask for hearings the most often after getting the paper reports was the court. And so the person who requested a hearing most often after CRB was the court. So, you know, that's still where the driving force is on it, and I think that's a good thing. And we also, in places where they have family court, that takes a group of hearings, of cases out where you don't have to have hearings so often because they're being seen every week or 2 weeks. And so, you know, in places where they have that, then this really isn't an issue for that group of people. And those tend to be your highest risk people.
Any other comments on? I added this to set the next hearing date in court. I think that's a good thing to keep because it's kind of common sense. But and my thought is, you know, we all have our limitations with our resources, but I don't think that should drive us deciding what the best practice is. We have to work with it, and we're going to do our best to achieve it. But there's the reality of all the resources for everybody at the table. So
I've done some observations over this past summer in five or six different counties, and in all of them, hearings were set in court. So I'm trying to remember the last time I've heard of a specific county where they don't set hearings in court or at least make that attempt. But I agree, it's really important that everybody get a date when everybody's there.
Any other thoughts or concerns on this modified courts and CRB best practices document?
Something else that isn't here that was definitely somewhere in the earlier stuff was the whole issue of finding absent parents. And sort of clarifying what steps need to be taken on that when there is a court hearing, inquiring of DHS, assuming that they continue to be carrying the bucket on this issue, where does that stand? I think we all have seen that this is an issue that has a way of getting swept to the side in dealing with the person who is there. And I believe probably is the single greatest contributor to delay in the resolution of permanency matters is service on the absent parents. I think it needs to be here somewhere.
Could that be a fourth bullet, excuse me, under CRB?
No, I think in the court, it's court.
I think it's court.
Yeah. Well, I can both, or both. I mean, no reason why I can't be both. But the first CRB is 6 months out, and one would hope that really would have been addressed before 6 months, right?
True. 6 months, yeah.
And I wonder, maybe if the court could regularly inquire regarding, I mean, we also have the cases where suddenly, when you're about to terminate parental rights, there's a dad,
yeah,
right? You know, and then he shows up in court, and then you are, how long into the case? When ask, and then biological father is here. And so sometimes I'm trying to push a little bit more on that issue about, can you please talk and find out who dad might be? So that was, I think in the last document,
so I think it's a legal requirement.
Right, that's what the
note, okay. For the diligent absent parent and relative search. And so in my mind, at least for the department, best practices is that everybody, all caseworkers be trained, adequately trained on the diligent search and identification of parents.
I think the problem is having it happen timely and getting people involved sooner. Mm-hmm. Which, for example, the incarcerated parents that, I've talked about that now a couple of times, both the CRB and the judges, there's, and the case that came out last year about their participation. Mm-hmm. What I'm still getting, I had one just the other day, and the guy's at Snake River, did you call into the shelter care? No. Well, he's right up there at Snake River. It's not even a long distance call, It needs to be done, and we had a discussion at JSIP about it, unless you could truly come in and say, we do not know where this guy is and we had no way of reaching him, there's no excuse for that at the shelter care. And I think in the past, the practice has been, well, mom's there, and she's the one we remove the kids from, so we're going to worry about who these other people are later. And that's going to just slow everything down.
Well, I think, I don't know, the court can push on that issue.
Somebody needs to.
Because it's just mind-boggling, like I said, when you're so far into a case and then all of a sudden this person whose name you've never heard before turns out through paternity testing to be dad. And it happens more frequently than I thought it would. So I think pushing that question a little bit, especially early on, or asking where people are, if you can find out about more relatives. If DHS needs to do it, but the court could still, I think...
Because a lot, and my experience too, is that a lot of times the mothers may be very inquisitive with the caseworker about it, but when she's looking at the judge and you say, all right, we're not going to screw around with this anymore, who's the daddy? They'll tell you.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between figuring out who the parties are and finding them and knowing where they are but not including them.
Right.
Which, and I think those should be addressed sort of in two separate ways. If we know where a dad is and we're just not noticing because he's in jail, that just doesn't—that's not good practice. But I do appreciate that.
Kansas or wherever he is.
Right. Yeah. If we know where he is and we're not involving him, that's one issue. If we don't know who he is, and we're not able to engage the mom in telling us, I think the assistance of the court would be wonderful in asking mom and getting her to tell. Certainly the courts could ask for the document we use when we're trying to identify a parent. We have a form that we fill out if there isn't a legal father, that we fill out with the mom.
Particularly when grandma's dad's mother's in the back of the courtroom, right?
Okay, any other concerns or thoughts about the modified courts and CRB best practices document?
So I don't know that this needs to be in there, mm-hmm. but I think it is helpful to the department when inquiry around visitation is made. It's not just whether or not it's happening, but how, where, and why at that level of supervision. So there's sort of a deeper inquiry around visitation that helps us be clear about why we're either requiring supervision mm-hmm. or not requiring supervision, or who we've chosen for the supervisor. So it talks about visitation. I don't know that we have to put that in there, but I do think that's an important piece of the case plan and how things move forward.
I think that may be kind of within the review adequacy of visitation okay. plan, because you would be looking at what's going on and then why, too. So
with an eye towards as the lowest level of monitoring necessary to preserve safety and still have a viable visit for the parent and child. It's just a note, I think it does cover that, would be covered by that.
That's exciting. Anything else? Otherwise, once we're done with this, we can move on to the next group.
Under court administration, it says, as funding permits, update the judicial and staff workload uh-huh. study. I am in the process right now of working on a contract with the National Center for State Courts to come in and do that for us. So we could maybe take this off. I don't know.
Well, but or leave it on, take out as funding permits, and say regular update. Because it's not a one-time event.
Okay, are we ready to move on to the attorney for children and parents? Does everybody have the one from last time still with them?
I don't.
You don't? Okay. Because we didn't get any we didn't get any updates for, and so I don't know if everybody's assuming this was fine from their end. We didn't need to modify anything, or do we need to make copies of these things? This was what Judge Welch had typed up, and so I thought you can just make copies. Thank you. I'm sorry. Did anybody make any modifications to their best practices for kind of your section that you didn't get turned in?
Amy emailed the state's attorney one back in August.
Okay.
So. To everybody, or
yeah.
August was a busy month.
August 18th.
That was so long ago.
That's what you get for being efficient.
And that was even later than after we talked.
Yeah, it was after we talked. We had to do it quickly though, because I was going on vacation. So.
I've got it in front of me.
Okay.
And Mike was on that too. So.
Okay.
So can I just recite what I think, given this document, how the department would reflect best practices for the courts?
Mm-hmm.
One is discovery upon appointment. I know that there was witness list production on that, and I actually don't believe the department should provide a witness list. I believe we should provide in discovery a list of contacts, but the creation of actual witness lists is a job for the attorney who's taking the case forward. And I've kind of, I know a lot of places put forward what they call a witness list, but I think it's really a list of contacts. And whether or not those people are witnesses that the attorney taking the case forward would use to prove the case is up to the attorneys to create a witness list to share with each other. But I do believe a list of case contacts is really appropriate. Clear expectations of the department for changes needed to resolve issues challenging the family, and clearly stated conditions for return. This is pre-jurisdictional. And a clearly defined visitation plan, pre-jurisdictional. Post-jurisdiction is continued discovery and notification, timely notification of the court for changes in case plan and request a hearing if required. And then training, we have a full array of training, but specific to the courts, I think we need training in court processes and how to present as a witness, and diligent relative and absent parent search is a required training. Both of those are on the training thing now, but it just emphasizes that in terms of best practices with the court, those are the specific trainings that relate to that. And if there's additional pieces, please.
I was just curious. Are you saying that all caseworkers are going to get training on how to do a diligent parent search?
Or is they do get training on diligent parent search and the requirements of the law with respect to finding parents.
Done by specialized staff?
Yeah, in lots of locations it is done by specialized staff, but it's covered in our core training. Legal parent relationships and search for relatives and parents.
I just wonder if that division of labor isn't an important thing to address. And, I mean, in my opinion, caseworkers shouldn't have to do anything other than provide the basic factual information they have to somebody who is trained to do that, which is my understanding of the way it's done. And of course, I may have blinders on in terms of the state, but.
So I don't view this as what caseworkers have to do at the courts, it's the department's responsibility, yep, right. And that's a piece of that. You're absolutely right, Judge Welch, that most caseworkers don't do it. And if we leave it to caseworkers, it's not going to happen in the way we need it to happen. But they're all trained about the need, what the law says, and that kind of thing. So that's why I put that on there. And it was just reflecting back, how is the department addressing this issue of best practice? What would our best practice be with respect to what the courts require? So, but you're right, we have a lot of division. I mean, we also, most caseworkers don't do all their visitation. In fact, most caseworkers do almost none of their visitation. We have other staff that do that. But they're responsible for the visitation plan. And when we go into court, the caseworker's gonna be the one responding to the judge around what we've done about the diligent parent search. Generally, the search clerk would come in and do that. So.
About the witness list, and I think maybe it's just a matter of semantics. I mean, at least in Multnomah County, what we're getting from the workers is a list of really contacts. This is the, you know, therapist with their contact, and usually a little blurb sort of identifying who this person is and what they know.
Right.
So we're talking about the same thing.
We are.
We're just labeling it differently.
Well, and I think, I guess for me, it's a little bit more than semantic,
okay.
Because, you know, we hear a lot about how we're not to practice law. And the creation of a witness list and who gets called in a case is the job of the attorney presenting the case and those defending. I think our obligation is to say, here's the people we've had contact with in the course of our investigation and assessment, and here's who they are, and here's why they were important. Whether or not you move forward with all those people as witnesses is a decision I think that the attorney makes. And so to me, it feels a little more than semantic because I think different attorneys interpret it differently, and I think DAs interpret it differently, and in part because I think DAs, and I won't say all DAs, I'm just speaking like, I've heard anecdotally different things.
At times.
It's not their responsibility to carry the case forward for the department, it's their responsibility to carry the case forward for the state, and so they, sometimes they say you have to create your witness list to a caseworker. As if the caseworker was going to do something, but in fact it's creating something that they can then take and use as their own, but they refer to it that way. And I just, best practice would be that it's very clear that that's not a caseworker function to create a witness list, in my opinion. But and in Multnomah it may be semantics.
Well, and I think we look at it as a potential witness list. I mean, we don't, you know, we send out a separate list based on who we decide off that list we're going to call. So I think we look at it as a potential witness list because the workers are the ones with, you know, the knowledge and the information of who these people are. But
yeah. And in my mind, that implies the worker knows who could be the witness. What they know is what this person told them. The attorney makes the decision about whether or not that's a witness. So.
And I think that is really important to make sure there's a clear line so that workers are not inadvertently practicing law, because it gets blurred from time to time. And so I think anything that, I mean, attorney functions should really be very separate from what any best practice is for your workers.
Yeah, it's so. Just the best practice. I mean, I know we're going to use the words we use. I just don't want it written that best practice is that the caseworker produces a witness list.
Right. No, I understand. I was just trying to clarify what you were envisioning.
Oh, okay, okay. It's probably the exact same list you're getting now.
That's different.
Yes, that's a different thing across the top.
Yeah. The only thing that's helpful about the word witness in a court report as opposed to contacts is I think it helps the defense attorneys and the parents understand these are the people that are likely to come into court and testify. Because it's just a term of art, I think, for parents when parents' attorneys are dealing with them. Okay, these are the people that are going to come testify, but I don't know that.
But who makes the decision they're the ones to come testify?
All the different attorneys do.
Exactly, but right. It's all the attorneys. That's my point. It's just
well, it
not
should be.
Yes.
It sure should be.
Yeah.
Whether it is or not. Isn't that kind of an underlying
Yeah, and that's the
here?
Best practice issue yes. for me.
Yeah, that in too many places the assistance that you get is modest.
Yeah, they just take that list and that's it. That's who they call. But I appreciate that there is a semantics issue and that different people practice differently.
Well, and I appreciate that things are sort of different around the state than just what we do in our little corner of the world.
Big corner.
Big corner. You're one quarter of the state of the world.
Lois?
Yes.
I couldn't write as fast as you were
I'm
talking.
Sorry.
No. So just so we're clear, you kind of
well,
went over some of the
writing
okay.
as
okay.
soon as I leave. I just wanted to say that this is sort of
your
yeah. I had a potential, but I didn't want to do it until
okay.
So
okay, great. So we're trying to get copies of the document that was sent in very early that I don't have handy, the August one. Sorry about that.
We do still get points for sending ours in early, right?
Good job. Thumbs up. So. Okay. I guess while we're waiting for that, what about CASA? We have the
Joanne, is it markedly different than what is here?
There's about three or four of the changes that we made.
Yeah, not
subtle.
Markedly different. Right.
I mean, I think
item.
We could almost work off of work off of this draft, and you could tell us.
Yeah,
what
I
the
think he's just
are.
Bringing it.
Or it works so hard to get it done early. I hate to.
Or
not
you could
have
just pull up your email from the 18th.
Right, I have it.
Okay, yeah.
That's why I'm comparing it and noticing that it's pretty similar.
Yeah,
there's
just
no,
some
there's like, I think
tweaking.
Only
there's
yeah.
about three changes or so. I mean, we had a
Lois
relatively shorter
Lois is also amount. Handing out the training matrix for child welfare that's coming around right now.
I don't think CASA has anything to add other than the training component to the draft that was just put out. It says permanency, CASA, permanency basic principles.
Mm-hmm.
And I apologize, I thought Megan was coming today and maybe she sent an email that I missed this morning, so.
Megan?
Was Megan on the line?
Yes.
Do you have, so the principles that Judge Welch had typed up earlier, did you have anything that you wanted to edit on that? Or were you comfortable with what?
The only edits would be just to change the language so it reflects, so similar to the language that's being used in the other best practice outline. So we're talking about under our basic principles for CASA, as an example, in number one, where we're talking about track the status of ICWA, we could use similar language that's being used by the court or the CRB in terms of best practice.
It's mod.
So
I think
all.
I think the word
the same.
I think the word that I would look for would be monitor, because that's what statute says, is that we're to monitor the case. So
right.
Monitor status of ICWA, monitor results of.
And there's a in number three, where it talks about in psychological evaluations and compliance with the findings, I would ask if we could change that to implementation of findings. We don't.
Or is that parents' compliance with the?
Yeah, I don't know. Is that parents or the department or?
I read it as parents' compliance,
okay.
But I think implementation is also a good word to.
Because we don't know. I mean, we don't. At least the department doesn't always require parents to do everything the psychological says. It's a tool and a
right.
diagnostic tool to help us create plans, but it's not. They don't always put forward the plan, and then we don't always require the parent to do everything that's in a psychological evaluation.
Sometimes the court does.
That's
so.
Fine.
But I think. But the point of this probably right was to make sure something's happening with
right,
it.
Once you get
not
it,
that.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Any other thoughts on the CASA best practices?
Oh, sorry if I missed it, but under that, what did we change it to? Track status of parent.
You could
just say
implementation of services and compliance
with
court directives, and that includes everybody.
Does the CASA want anything in the basic principles about working with the department to sort of drive the case plan or ensure the case plan meets the needs of the child or something to that effect?
Yes, that's a great recommendation.
We'd like it.
I would like it as well. I think CASA would. So
I have a question about that. I thought that CASA's role was actually more to be a little bit more independent than that. I mean, I think there are cases where the CASA actually feels like that their role is to advocate for a case plan that is something other than what DHS has recommended.
There is
and
that.
So I wonder if that's perhaps too broad a statement. You know, maybe it should be more nuanced to capture those instances where the CASA has a view that is different than the agency view.
What about ensuring that the case plan meets the needs of this
that's,
of
I think
the child?
That is probably
that's where
a better
I was headed,
statement.
Was, and that's actually more what I heard was that we're there to ensure that there is a case plan and that it is addressing all the needs that have been identified. And any other thoughts on CASA? Megan, anything else on the phone?
No.
Okay. And then now everybody should have the best practices for prosecute.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's all right.
Should have buzzed in earlier.
I'm just used to, in Lane County, we move things a lot.
I know, I
gotta
catch up.
Go ahead.
So under number two of the CASA part, so it says track results of AAG initial legal review. Yeah, it's just kind of worded, it's worded oddly because the legal review is a staffing between an attorney and a client. But maybe it's just, you know, a time to check in on the case, or and then not every county do we do legal reviews because there's we don't do them in Lane where we're representing DHS at the jurisdictional phase and Polk and other counties we have different pilots kind of going on. So if it's explained what the point was for that part, we can phrase it a little differently to make it apply to the state.
Maybe we could leave AAG out. And maybe it just says initial legal review.
So how about if we said track development of department, track department's development of case plan and any changes? I mean, because what happens as we go into a legal review, we may or may not change anything, but really what you all want to know is, as a, you know, at this point in time, you've done an activity that you've reviewed the case plan. We want to know if there's a change or if we're status quo. But we may change the plan completely outside of a consultation with our council, and you guys need to know it. And I think that's what I put in the best practices for the department as well, is that we need to notify the court if there's a change in the plan.
And I think under 3363, there is the requirement now that under the new legislation that passed effective last January, that within 10 days of any modification to the case plan, that all parties are notified. So that's already been a statutory change. So
maybe monitor development and implementation and any changes in case plan.
I think we're back to the word monitor.
Okay.
And do we want to add to that an implementation of any court or CRB, court orders or CRB recommendations?
It has the CRB recommendations.
Right.
Court orders. Their definition overall. Yeah.
And that captures what you wanted to.
I think it does.
Okay.
Megan, do you have any thoughts? I think that still captures what we were hoping for.
Well, I think it captures, in number two, you mean, I think it captures what we're looking for. I'm going back to the court and the CRB best practices that we just reviewed, where we're saying anything that's already that we're legally supposed to be doing, we didn't put it into best practice. So for CASA, legally, we're already supposed to be monitoring the court orders. That's what our statute's telling us to do. So I think pulling out these other things, identifying the CRB recommendations and the case plan changes, monitoring those, it's good to call out in best practice.
Okay. There's a line in there somewhere between a best practice that declares what the law is and a best practice that talks about how to go about following it. And I think that that's a difference here. I don't see this stuff as saying what the law is. If you apply that strictly, there wouldn't be any documents here at all, because at least by interpretation, everything that we're talking about follows from the intention of the of the various pieces of legislation. I don't know exactly where that line would be, but.
So it may be that what we need to do when we put these all together in final form is have a preamble that says best practices, at its core is following the laws that exist with respect to how we report through the court system. These are in addition to that, or interpreting laws that were unclear around how to follow through.
Anything else for CASA? Taking a pause. Long pause.
Present now, John.
Okay.
I'm done. I said my piece.
Everybody okay to move forward right now? I just need to know if anybody wants to take a break. Nope. Okay. Do we want to go to the document that was turned in early? The one that you pulled up on your email, the August, the DOJ and DA.
Okay. So I said this at the last meeting, but I'll say it again. I think it's very important that DAs and AAGs have practice standards, not just caseload standards. And I think that's the piece that's lacking in the best practices document. We still don't have any documented practice standards for lawyers who practice in this area when they're representing the state or DHS. Okay. And I know they do at the ABA level.
I think it was on that bigger document.
It seems to me it should be in this document because so much of what we hear about variance in county practice has to do with the fact that there are varying levels of understanding of child development and family dynamics and case planning alternatives. And that is such a core piece of juvenile practice, and it's so different than a criminal practice. And for this best practices document to not address any of that and to not touch on any of the pieces that really are unique to juvenile practice, I think it leaves too big a gap, in my view.
So where, what should it say?
I think there should be that best practice is to adopt practice standards that include training components unique to juvenile practice. Something along those lines that gets at that piece about child development, family dynamics, services available in the community, as well as other pieces unique to juvenile practice.
Would you put that on the one for attorneys for parents and children too?
It's already there.
It is. Mm-hmm. Oversight and standards at the bottom.
Oh,
number one.
It was on.
I don't think it says anything about training unique to juvenile
practice. I have the state performance standards part is at the bottom. Adoption of it.
For juvenile court practice.
Ours is on the oversight and standards. Adoption of state performance standards consistent with ABA and OSB standards.
For juvenile court practice. Just asking if that's the addition you'd put there. There's lots of ABA and OSB standards, but it's specific to the juvenile court practice that you want that, right?
Yeah.
So that's where you get the child development and all that.
Right.
I wouldn't know by looking at that it included mm-hmm. child development. That's why I'm asking if you want to add that word.
Oh, well, it's in there already. The thing is, we already have the standards, and it is in there. So you can turn to the Oregon State Bar standards, and you can read
the
child's lawyer. It's all there.
Okay.
And that was on the big one that Angela Sherbo and I first looked at a while back when we were looking at the provision of legal services in a timely manner under DOJ DA strategies. It was adoption of an education regarding the standards for petitioner. I thought it was also the there was reference I thought to the ABA standards.
Is it under training or
oversight
and standards?
Probably under oversight and standards, right?
Yeah. And it should mirror the language that we use for the attorneys for children and parents. Same kind of standards.
I'm not sure there is set out of standards for state's attorneys as there are for parents and children, both with the Oregon State Bar and with the ABA.
The Oregon State Bar does not have any standards.
No, the ABA.
But
ABA
does.
Has standards for state's attorneys.
Joanne?
Yeah.
You took the language that was in the big this one and took all of the mandatory elements out of it, or Lori did.
Well,
I really question that. Where?
Which part are you looking
well,
at? One by one, maybe.
Probably the most important one would be, the most important to me is the first one, but that's not what I'm talking about right now. Establish and enforce minimum attendance at juvenile CLEs, juvenile law training academy CLEs, was changed to strongly encourage. Now, nobody else is being strongly encouraged to do things. The whole idea of this is that people should go to the training that is appropriate for their job, not just to be encouraged to go. I don't even know what that means, Lori. Dear Lori, I'm sorry, but I don't know what that means, other than everything's fine and we don't need to do anything different.
Yeah, I don't think that was the intent.
No, that was not our intent.
I think when we were looking at to enforce attendance at a CLE, so I guess that would be the DA's office saying you shall go.
How about change enforced to require? That's actually a little milder. In other words, that's what you're supposed to do, not just you're encouraged to do it.
Although in some ways,
we don't have a require on attorneys for children and parents.
We don't?
No. It just says training and education. It doesn't
say,
they're required or strongly encouraged. They just say, here they are.
If we back up a minute, I'd like to go back to something Judge Lev said earlier when we were talking about the best practices for courts and, you know, scheduling hearings every 90 days. And I think your comment, Judge, was that these are what we would hope for, although recognizing that best practices don't always happen. So I think some language somewhere in between require and strongly encourage, you know, state's attorneys and DDA shall have training in this area, which is a little short of required, a little more than strongly encouraged, but I think goes back to this is a list of what would be the best practices, putting aside budget constraints and that sort of thing that we were talking about earlier. So I think maybe more middle of the road language of simply shall have that training in the same way that it talks about for children's attorneys.
There are sort of
or
an
just,
ultimate Scrivener here that's going to make all of this stuff more
or how
consistent.
About just on number
Leola
three.
Leola takes great notes.
Yeah,
I'm watching.
Looking, she's writing. I'm watching.
How about on number three under training, have it get rid of the first four words and have it say attendance at, which is neither require nor encourage, but simply states that is the best practice, is that there is attendance at those trainings.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Do the same thing on attorneys for children and parents. Huh?
Right.
It's already, actually, the children and parents is already written that way. And it's possibly because our it says advanced training, ABA trainings.
But it doesn't say attended.
Which we just
so
say.
It's the trainings, which is the best practice, which is what I think we're getting at. That's the best practice is you have these trainings.
And,
yeah.
Right. So and we'll people, just, our contracts actually require all juvenile lawyers for children and parents to attend 16 hours every contract cycle. So we have it, and I don't mind putting it in there, but it's already a requirement.
So the best practices would be they have these trainings. And I think best practices for public attorneys is they have these trainings.
Absolutely.
Best practices for the department is they have these trainings. We also have a ton of required trainings, but we don't have a contract. But
and having the language mirror makes sense to me. So
yes.
Instead of just advanced training, it would be attendance at advanced training.
Right. I would advocate for insertion of the word required in both,
mm-hmm.
because I think that it's one thing to offer, but it's another thing to make sure that people actually go.
You want regular and ongoing attendance at these CLEs,
yeah, that's
right?
Good. Well,
yeah, I see. A best practices document isn't, I guess I'd kind of agree with Lori. It's less than you're required to do this practice. That's your contract. That's how we get to best practices. But what are the best practices is a different document. Then we can talk about for each of our groups, how do we get to that level? And some of that is around, you know, contractual agreements. Some of it's around finances. There's a lot of different influences to that that then we have to grapple with to meet the best practice standards.
So I think that I agree to the extent that a best practice is describing what an individual lawyer is supposed to do, but I thought these best practices were actually supposed to describe what we were doing as institutionally. And so I think as an institution, I am requiring the lawyers who practice to get the training, whereas if you're talking about at the individual level, the best practice is to regularly attend. I thought we were talking about at the system level, what is our job as the people who oversee the practitioners? So I take a somewhat, you know, on the...
I didn't take it that way, so that's just my different look at it, I guess.
Yeah, I like the wording regularly attend trainings.
Do the performance standards cover the training component too?
Right.
I can read it to you. I have it pulled up. the lawyer accepting appointment of retainers to represent children, this is for children, in dependency and TPR cases, should participate in 16 hours of continuing legal education relating to juvenile law each year.
Oh, should? That's interesting.
That's not our contract.
That's the
performance stand. That's the Oregon State Bar's.
And then to do that, they have to have a contract, which then it says in the contract that they have to do the training.
So the Oregon State Bar standards apply to all juvenile practitioners, not just public defense practitioners, but private practitioners. Those are their standards.
Right.
Our contract is a different.
Right.
And that is what applies only to public defense lawyers. Publicly funded lawyers, I should probably say.
And that's because OPDS, Office of Public Defense Services, has made the commitment that attorneys that we contract with shall have these things. So I think the question is DOJ willing to make that commitment that attorneys who represent the state also have some level of training in child development?
And then what about DAs? Because that's, you're here, there's a DA voice at the table, but every DA's office is different.
As we know, there are 36 counties
yes.
in Oregon, and they all do things a little differently. I can't make commitments for all 36
right.
DAs. I can certainly share the information with them. But I think, again, when we get to best practices, which is what they're going to see, is the regularly attend. I mean, if you put the word required, I don't know that that changes the response you get from the 36 elected DAs. We're certainly not using words like required when we talk about the judge's training. It simply says shall be trained.
And I think from DOJ's perspective, absolutely, we're committed to ongoing trainings, and we do them internally. We don't have the funding to send I don't have money to send my 48 lawyers to every juvenile law CLE. It's too much money, and it takes people away. But we do have a limited number that we rotate, and we try to make sure every attorney gets an opportunity to go, and we do internal CLEs that we put on and do those kind of, which I'm sure like OPDS, and they have their kind of internal trainings too.
Right.
So that's, I think, why it was kind of trying to, if we can capture that somehow the, commit to providing training opportunities, yes, we can absolutely do that, maybe in a way to phrase it.
Provision of training opportunities in the following areas, child development, whatever you believe is relevant to an effective practice in juvenile court.
I think the whole point of the training for everyone, right, is you want to ensure that everybody that's working on these issues with this very specialized area of law isn't going in blind. Otherwise, that affects children and families negatively, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so my thought is you want every entity, I think, wants a commitment to ensure that their attorneys are properly educated and trained regarding this area of law and have regular ongoing updates to stay apprised of the current state of things change, and this is not an area, and I think that you can just send somebody in. It just doesn't work for every single person or a group that's represented at the table. I don't think you can have somebody DA or DOJ attorney, and I'm not saying that they do, but, to go to one two-hour CLE, and that's ever going to work for you to have a clue how to do the work. And so then how do you word it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
That sounded good.
I never remember what I say right away. Go back and listen.
Ensure all attorneys have. Yeah.
What happens when you become a judge? You can rely on the transcript.
So is it ensure regular and ongoing training?
I think that is a good selection of words.
in the following areas, or do we want to say that? Do we want to be that specific, or are we just say ensure
training? Well, I don't know. This group could grapple with, and I know you have your separate standards, but grapple with if there's some core things that everybody ought to have, like child development, I think is really a good one, but not usually a legal training.
Honestly. Right.
So
ensure.
I think that's where if you get to this, if you can adopt the standards, then it's all there. Mm-hmm. And so when you, then you can pick a phrase like, mm-hmm. you know, ensure regular training to
meet the standards.
Meet ABA
practice
standards.
Sure.
That is.
So maybe, Joanne, you could just take, or you and Lori could look at what the defense bar has and or not defense bar, but I don't know.
Oregon State Bar.
Thank you. Maybe y'all could look at what is, you know, enumerated there and say, could we adopt this as the best standard for public attorneys or not?
And I think that was, I was a member of the committee that talked about the standards for the parents and kids attorneys, and the thought was, could we adopt standards for all DAs? And it was not, I think. As Lori said, there was many counties with many different opinions, and so we at DOJ work towards the ABA standards, but of course they're slightly off because it's the caseload minimums are way out of whack. They're a lot lower, and so, but we could adopt some version of that, which we could include, adoption of
ABA standards
or practice standards. And I think it's tricky because, you know, the system in Oregon doesn't work the same as it does in other states, and so the ABA standards are for the nation, and so the wording that they use and the requirements that they have don't necessarily apply if we're not doing the jurisdictional work or if we are. So it would take a finesse, and it would take an ability to do it, and if we did it, it would just be for DOJ lawyers as opposed to states lawyers. So, I mean, we could do it, but it's, or we could just come up with kind of generic focus on training and take the pieces out of those standards that are important to folks.
That's what I see.
If the, if we got buy-in from ODAA, Lori and I could go and present together, United Front, deflect from each other.
I think the point for DA's offices, you do have the variety. That is always going to be present. But the point is, if you're going to send somebody in to do this work, they can't just go to the DA's conference. That's not going to work for them, right? They need to have something, and this is very, very different than the everyday training and work that 95% of the DAs do, right?
So. Right, and we were trying to capture that particularly on 1 and 2 in terms of, DA's offices to provide in-house training, including some regional exchanges with smaller communities, that, as a way to encourage sort of some of that. And 2, I think, was directly related to some of the issues that folks have about them not being trained to the specific jurisdictional issues and case law.
Well, what if we take a short break right now, and then people can kind of think, because this is one where I don't think everybody's on a different page, it's just coming up with what language is going to work for this, and maybe a pause will help with that. So, 10 minutes. Judge Sullivan and Megan, is that okay?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay. Okay.
We have a suggestion.
Yeah, we have a suggestion that might work. So if we, under training, and the thought is maybe we have this sentence under, there we go.
Hello?
Hey, this is Megan.
Hi, Megan. Okay.
Okay. So if we have maybe this sentence under the attorneys for children and parents and state's attorneys, and then we could kind of tweak it underneath the sentence. So if we started with ensure regular and ongoing training specific to juvenile law practice, and then underneath that, we could include under the best practices document we presented, our 1, 2, and 3, we could make A, B, and C like included under that heading. And then under the attorneys for children and parents, if it was that same heading, ensure regular and ongoing training specific to juvenile law practice, and then they could to, you know, put underneath that the parts you already have, or we could work on making them consistent together.
Right, that's fine. And then are you thinking of having under caseload, under changing your caseload standards back to standards and oversight? Or
maybe under oversight and standards we put in
adoption of practice standards unique to juvenile practice.
Yeah. And I think I can commit to that from DOJ. I don't know if we want to make it a state's attorney practice standards, or you know, or we could separate it out. We could have a DOJ adoption of best practice standards, and then two states. I don't know.
Well, I think, again, I can't commit for 30-60 days. I certainly think that looking at adopting some best practice standards is a good step. You know, I can't commit that they're all going to agree what those would be.
It's pretty mild.
I think it is pretty mild, yeah. And again, as best practices, there should be standards that are adopted. And if the goal of this is these are the best practices you should strive for, I don't have any problem with that.
And I think the bar has been very consistent. You know, they just adopted standards again for criminal and juvenile practice for both public and private lawyers, as we discussed. And they're very clear that these are best practice standards. They're not disciplinary.
Right.
Standards. They're what we ought to be striving to do.
Right.
And I think it's tweaking maybe the ABA standards to fit our model, because you know it says things in those standards that what a DOJ has a client, DAs
right.
do not have a client.
Right.
So when you know we can't say certain things because they don't apply to both of us.
Right.
It says ensure for the next hearing you do this and this. Well, DAs are out. They're not at the next hearing.
You know, maybe this should talk about the development of best practice standards, sort of in terms of a goal is to develop those standards
develop
for state's attorneys
adoption
and for
of
DOJ.
Best practice
Because I think
standards.
That's really what we're talking about, is how do we develop those standards that don't currently exist in this context.
Right. Right. And I think similarly I wasn't on the work group that addressed the juvenile standards, but my understanding is that group looked to the ABA standards and then created something that fit Oregon's model. So I think they've done, you were on the group. I think that's essentially what happened.
Yeah, I came in a little bit late and they had kind of a model already in place. I don't remember referring back to the ABA, but they may have, because I think when I got on, there was already a format.
Got it.
So we could say something under our oversight and standards. I mean, I think if we want to leave number one, if you think that's important, because we kind of show from both sides how we should or be providing some oversight. And then so one would be oversight and two would be the standards. So development and adoption of best practice standards, period. Or do we want
development and development and adoption of best practice standards?
Yeah, that's what.
Does best practice standards get it confused with this document? Should it be
performance standards? What are we calling it?
Is it just practice standards?
Because you have state performance standards in the oversight and standards for the attorneys for children and parents, and that's, I mean, the point, right, is that
yep.
DAs and DOJ don't have it yet. Let's make sure we have some standards for them to work by.
So, development and adoption of performance standards for states, for DOJ and...
For lawyers representing state and DHS, right?
Yeah, and that leaves it open then if we do need to splinter it separately, or we can keep it together,
right.
Or there's parts
exactly.
that don't make sense. Okay. So what about that training part? Did that seem to make sense, that sentence about training?
Uh-huh.
And then do we want to adopt that
same
language under attorneys for children and parents, but being able to flesh it out that makes sense for your program?
I like the idea of having language similar for similar concepts throughout the whole document.
Right.
It'll flow much better.
Right. That's probably one of the weaknesses of the document right now, is we're all trying to drive at the same thing, but we've all taken a different approach in how we describe it. So at some point.
And that is the same word that's used for the courts and CRB, ensure. So.
Anything else? So I've kind of got the Attorneys for Children and Parent document right next to the DOJDA one. Any other issues coming up for anybody to discuss on these?
And I think, so they flow. I mean, I remembered when we left that it was, if we take these kind of bullet point items and make them into a sentence, I thought that was the goal. So then it would read more like a, not like an outline, or in an outline form, but would read like a sentence would read. So I don't know if that was the goal, or if we want to, because I'm not clear under training and education on number two for children and parents. Advanced training, colon, attorneys presenting to JSIP trainings. That doesn't, I'm not sure what that means. So I don't know if it would be a sentence of advanced training, you know, and then explain in a sentence or.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, I've made a note, amend language to track structure of other entities. So okay, once I see your structure or, you know, whoever, we'll fix it up.
I'm not sure what that means either, Nancy, about attorneys presenting to JSIP trainings.
The idea was that attorneys should be presenters and talk about their perspective in JSIP, that there should be an opportunity for attorneys.
That's my recollection, is that was the point of that bullet, right?
So then should it be on the both? Should it be on the state's attorneys
as well?
Well,
and we took it off our list.
Oh, okay.
Because I think that there are certainly times, and we had attorneys this year do the Court of Appeals piece at the JSIP conference, and there have been attorneys in the past who've done other various topics. But I don't think that we wanted to have a commitment that at every conference there was going to be an opportunity for attorneys to present, because it depends on the topics and the expertise and all of that.
I think the concept of the multidisciplinary training kind of across the board is a good one for everybody. So like if we look at Model Court Day and what we can accomplish by having everybody at the table at some form of training is beneficial to this overall process.
And we have that under training for the courts.
Right, so it may kind of already be within some of these.
I'm just thinking for the JSIP, it could be, there could be a benefit to doing like a three things you always wanted to ask each group, like why do you always do it, you know, why is that always the case, and having like if it was, you know, someone from ODAA presenting for the DAs, me or somebody from my shop for DOJ, maybe Nancy or Amy presenting from OPDS, and kind of that way it's not a specific attorney who practices in juvenile court presenting, but maybe more of a, I don't know, just throw it out there.
Right.
No, and I think that's a great idea, and it's something that I can write down, and we can make sure that
we don't
talk about that as a possible topic area for the next conference. But to me, having it here seems like it's something that every single year we need to be thinking about what we could do to include attorneys as presenters.
We just cross that one out then.
I was thinking, you know, I think this was group language, and I suspect it was actually intended to capture what was already happening, because I think JSIP does include, I mean, I've spoken at JSIP, the DOJ and our lawyer, you know, just spoke at JSIP. So maybe what it's trying to capture is just the idea that lawyers for parents, children, and the state and DHS should be prepared to participate in JSIP trainings as requested, you know, with the idea that, you know, not that it's required every year, but that that's a piece that
should be happening, that's
part of the multidisciplinary. So maybe it's a matter of how we phrase it as opposed to whether we're taking it out completely or leaving it as is. So I'd be happy to work on that language to try and come up with something.
Doesn't it belong in the court discussion rather than in the attorney discussion?
Yeah, that's possible too.
I mean, to the extent it belongs anywhere, Leola, it seems like it should be in court because it's talking about training of judges, but without saying so, because that's what JSIP is.
But right, like if I were phrasing it for me, I would say having people willing and willing and ready if asked. But
I mean, I think in some ways it is captured under the court's best practices document under training, where it says JSIP continue to sponsor and support judicial officer and multidisciplinary education programs. I think it is actually captured there.
And I think it should come out of this, because I think that's too specific, Nancy, to talk about as a best practice is that lawyers should be willing to go and tell judges what they're doing wrong. I think that that takes...
They might think it's best practice.
We discourage them from taking that approach.
But I think the number one under training and education for attorney for children and parents is, again, we've got that multidisciplinary component related identified there. And the point is, we should be supporting each other, and if you're asked to go help with a training, go speak at a training, no matter which group you're here for. I think we kind of already do that, so.
And maybe that's something, once that language is tweaked, it could be put in both sections, because I think it does fit there. And I think, you know, the Juvenile Law Training Academy started out, like, you know, it was a more parents and kids oriented training, and then the invitation was extended to DOJ and DAs to attend, and so we try and encourage that more, because it is great to sit with folks that you're not aligned with in some cases, but, you know, to
practice
takes out the adversarial nature sometimes when you see that we're all attorneys in this same field and we all want to do what's right for these kids. So to actually call out the Juvenile Law Training Academy is great, because then I think it's that is that one I mean, there's always the OSB Juvenile Law CLE, but that's the Juvenile Law Training Academy really seems to be more of the nuts and bolts and intro, and a much bigger attendance, so you get that kind of draw. And so if using that as an example of that multidisciplinary collaborative training with all parties and participants, you know, Bill Taylor has come to that training academy, we've got CASAs that go to it, so it is a nice group.
I want to go back to the item one on the DOJ, DA thing, the business about publication. You know, this practice of having caseworkers or an agency that provides social services to be engaged in a function that is otherwise in every other area of legal practice performed by lawyers. Completely. It is not, I mean, I don't know, maybe there's several lawyers in the room that, I don't know if you've been in private practice, but this is not something that somebody else does. This is something a lawyer does. We may have an investigator or somebody working for them and in a sense, the caseworkers are investigators on this issue, and it's a very important part of their work to find out who the family is and, you know, that kind of stuff. But this is just one of these things. It's been this way since the beginning of time, that this is not a function that's performed under the direction of an attorney. And it's just wrong. The amount of resources the DHS wastes on this, in my opinion, is outrageous. Because they, you know, and Lori's a witness. We tried so hard in Portland to change the practice so the affidavits for publication quit being 25 pages long and referring to contacting the police department in Omaha, Nebraska without indicating why the police department in Omaha, Nebraska was relevant to finding this person. And they're down to maybe 4 or 5, 6 page, you know, and again, I haven't been there for a while, so maybe they grew or got smaller. But if I could change one thing, it would be that some money that DHS spends on publication type efforts be transferred to the Department of Justice and the DA's offices, and they hire their own people to do the work, and they do it. This is a legal issue. What is it that constitutes a reasonable effort to find people? And having done adoption work when I was in private practice, the affidavits for adoption are usually a page or a page and a half long. There's not that much there, and they're strange. Some of those are stranger adoptions. It doesn't. The amount of time and energy that is spent is a crime, Lois. It's a crime. It's unnecessary.
But I also, and I actually would take it a step further. My opinion is that attorneys should be driving service-related issues, period. I mean, unless you're going to personally serve somebody, because what I have seen happen, and I don't think it's cost-effective, is when service gets botched, and we're not even talking about publication, and there's a blank stare, you have to comply with the statute to get your service done. And when there's not really an attorney saying you need to do X if you want to look at alternative service, the motions need to get filed and whatnot, I think that is precisely where DHS is engaging in the practice of law, and it's not fair. And I think wheels get spun. If the person's not served properly, then you have a delay to get to jurisdiction. And I think it ends up costing everybody a lot more money and resulting in delay. And so I think it goes beyond just the publication issue. And I agree, I was in private practice. Service is tricky. Service can be tricky. And I have seen enough now in my limited time, and I was of the opinion before, but I'm convinced that it is it's critical to not just have an attorney signing off on something, but to really be much more involved in service if you're not getting somebody personally served, particularly, you know? And
my preference would be that the department's not involved in service.
Mm-hmm, at all.
There's lots of places where we are responsible for serving witnesses, and I don't think that's our function.
And that kind of, you know, when we talked about where's that line, you know, witness list, right, not having DHS be doing legal function, I think that's really, really important to stay on track with. But service, I have very strong feelings about that, beyond even what you described. So I would, best practices, I would almost include attorneys, because it's not just prosecutors, because we're different. I mean, of course, Lane is different, but attorneys handling jurisdictional hearings, something, you know, will be actively involved to ensure proper service on parties.
And I think the rub again becomes, mm-hmm. I think different counties do it differently. In mm-hmm. Multnomah County, the juvenile department mm-hmm. is we've got two folks in the juvenile department under Lavoris that are arranging service. They serve parents that show up for mm-hmm. prelims, and then if the worker comes up with an address, they fill out a form, send it to one of the two juvenile department employees, who then arrange the service on that address. So that's just, I think, different. I think we just have to be careful how we word it. We certainly are always actively involved, and the DA absolutely should be involved in directing how that service gets done, but I think every county does it a little differently.
Some counties, the DAs ask the department, they give the department the documents for service.
Right, and I don't think that's appropriate either. We don't.
And part of it for me is that we have an engagement model. Our safety model is based on engagement, and it's difficult to engage people in this you know, sort of more therapeutic way, and then turn around and hand them their court document, absolutely, saying show up.
Because this is a best practices document rather than a statute to change procedure, I don't know what it will take if it ever can happen. I'm considering my age. I'm no longer expecting to see this actually occur in my lifetime, but I think what goes in a best practices is not statutory language or whatever. I mean, I'm not even sure how you'd write a statute that says this is done by the prosecutors. How do we get there and work closely? My ladies, sounds like everything's fine. We don't need to change anything. That's not an aspirational goal, to work closely.
I think, you know, even if you have differences among the counties about how this work is getting done, I think there are some counties that perhaps, I think it's a fair statement to say there are some counties that are putting too much on DHS, and the attorney, DA or DOJ, is not really doing too much to make sure it gets done right. And then, like I said, this is very fresh. I'm going to just tell you, it's very fresh, these issues. And so something to, you know, that aspirational, but, you know, the attorney's got to be monitoring and directing service. That's a completely legal function, and I think you can't avoid that.
And I think it's like if you look at 419B 827, it talks about responsibility for cost of service of summons, and it says when DHS issues the summons, responsibility for such payment shall be borne by the county. That's been an ongoing struggle for a number of years. But when DHS is issuing the summons,
and
It's the split too, because again, it's DOJ consulting with our client on ongoing matters about service and maybe needing to be more involved in that end. And we could, that's a good item to be in for best practice. And then you've got the state,
mm-hmm.
when the state's position coincides with DHS's position to ensure that service, I mean, sometimes their positions don't align. So when you're saying the state should do this, it's got to line up exactly with.
What about that prosecutors should develop standards for service?
Legally effective service.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or I liked what I think maybe Nancy said too. That, did you write that down as you said it? I don't know if you did. Something about.
I was feeling guilty about interrupting, actually. I think I said ensure effective service.
Well, and what I just wrote down coming off that is, you know, AG's and DA's office will be actively involved to ensure proper legal or to ensure legal service of parents.
But I'm curious about whether that statute is having, like, does the statute need to change? Because that seems like a relatively easy statute.
But it says when.
When DHS
and that begs the question,
issues the summons.
It doesn't mean that DHS has to do it.
Right, but does that statute, and I don't know, does it create some economic pressure to push the workload somewhere such that
it just says when we do it, the county bears the cost. Isn't that what it says?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So it's really a financial statute. It's not a direction around who's
but
to
it,
do it.
But it does show
but
yeah.
does it create a
I say it's a presumption that we can.
Right.
But does it create a financial incentive to have you do it? For someone, you know what I mean? Is that why it gets pushed to you? I don't know. I'm asking the question.
Yes, I think. Well, I mean, I do think that's part of it, right? Because it's a caseload.
Who has the incentive then?
Well, it's a caseload issue for some DAs in some counties. They don't have the time necessarily devoted to handling these cases in the same way that other counties do. And so I think sometimes they push this stuff back to DHS because it's like, just give me the file and I'll walk in and do the hearing.
Yeah, well, that's exactly
that's not an
right.
incentive.
So, I mean, that's the incentive, I think, is to push the because it's time out of their calendar and their dockets and their
workload.
I was
thinking the financial incentive. So you're talking about workload incentive.
But same thing, like that maybe that office wouldn't want to pay a DA to do the work at half time. They pay, you know, they give twice the amount of work to one person.
But it seems like that statute actually protects DHS. Like,
mm-hmm.
the county's going to bear the cost either way.
But they don't. I mean, there's a statute.
The workload cost.
Right.
But they do bear the financial cost. But you're saying they don't even do that?
Not in some counties, no.
Just refuse?
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me the citation?
Yeah, it's 419B827.
Can I ask a follow-up question? Does the agency ever bill the county for the cost of service?
You know, I don't know the answer to that.
The question is, how old is the statute and when did you all give up?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question, too, Judge.
And it does say on there, it's formerly 419B280, so it's obviously jumped to the, so it's probably an old version that just stayed in.
Well, and I think that statute is the reason why our juvenile department is now in charge of doing, because there was a period of time where we would actually do some service. Parents showed up in court, the DA would fill out the summons. And there was an issue that came up regarding that leaving us financially responsible for some things that were a problem. And that might have been the old version of the statute, though.
I'll find out if we bill.
And actually, what this says, and this is why we got out of the business of serving, is the court may authorize payment of travel expenses of any party summoned. Responsibility for the payment of the cost of service or summons or other process. Payment for travel expenses shall be borne by the party issuing the summons. That's when we quit issuing summons.
Except then the next sentence. I think the next sentence clarifies that.
But I think that's why you're going to get reluctance from DA's offices, because we had a case several years ago where the defense came in and said, the DA's office served the summon. My client's in California. DA's office pay for my client to get here. And we're like, oh, yeah, we're not doing that. So that's why our juvenile department is now issuing those summonses, and we are not. And that's where you're going to get the pushback from the DA's offices to, or I would assume from the AG's office, to issue the summons out of their office, because then they're responsible for that payment.
No, because we're the attorney for DHS. So it would be DHS being responsible.
They would just charge us.
Yes, but so, you don't want that expense either.
I should find out if we have that expense anyway. I mean, I think your point is, do we actually turn around and bill? I don't know. And how often is the bill declined or just not? I don't know.
Yeah, just understanding the mechanics of it might be helpful.
It would be good if we had a best practice expectation that was stood alone and apart from the financial resolution of that expectation.
And I propose that it's, at least for starters, the first sentence or the first try is that prosecuting offices, whatever the terminology is used, develop standards for proper service on parties to these proceedings. This is how to do it.
Yeah.
And it can have more. I mean, but that would be the first step, is what is the right way to do this?
Well, and develop, I think what you're looking for is consistent standard amongst the 36 counties and how parents are served.
Yeah. But I assume whoever does the work first will have lots of enthusiastic mimics, right?
Who's serving in Lane County?
HF, I think. But, I mean, my problem is not so much the who's issuing it and how, it's not that first step. It's if they can't find the person and they want to do alternative service.
Yeah, that's really
And it's, yeah. it's, I don't know how much communication actually occurs between the worker and DOJ. On a global level, I had suggested multiple times for DHS to go talk to DOJ to clear some things up, to find out that it actually never happened until the last minute. So, you know, then it may be a billing issue, but again, I think that it actually would likely save money in the long run to put a little bit more money up front to do it right, instead of, here's your alternative service documents, Judge, at fact finding. Did you file a motion? Oh.
So you guys aren't with us in shelter hearings in Lane?
No.
Okay. That might solve that, huh?
I have another question. Sorry, but how do they do it in other states? Are there DHS entities that actually have a service division? You know, I know some, my understanding is that some, in some states, DHS has counsel embedded in the agency.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if that is how some other states get around that issue, and whether, if there's a communication issue, you know, maybe one other way to resolve the issue is a recommendation that DHS offices have internal lawyers who, to perfect service. And I'm not suggesting it as a solution. I'm just asking a question because it seems like to the extent that there's a difficult time making sure that the caseworker has adequate time to tell the DOJ or DA what's happening. And
I think developing some standards, though, because it really, I think there needs to,
particularly around the alternative service.
There needs to be a legal eye on that issue, and maybe it comes from getting some standards in place. Right. Because then I think if that's not there, then you're asking the agency to be interpreting the statutes and really doing it's a very much a legal, I always think of service as a legal function, a pure legal function. And so I think if there's the standards there, then somebody can follow through with the act, and then that has to get sorted out who's doing it. But I just think there has to be a better, you have to ensure that there's that good communication about how things are getting done.
So what if we said under basic principles, one, develop standards for proper legal service, and it would be under the state's attorney DOJ thing, so it does apply, and then we could determine if it applies to all of us or how to break it apart, but that there should be standards for proper legal service. And then two, attorneys should ensure effective legal service in each case.
I like that. And I think that because if you think about some DA's offices where the new person's going to get sent into juvenile court as opposed to an experienced attorney, if you've just been doing criminal law, a standard prosecutor's job, you are not dealing with service. You are not ever dealing with statutes like that. If you happen to maybe have some civil experience, then it won't be as foreign. But, you know, that's just not part of your practice in regular DA life.
You probably just described why it is the way it is,
mm-hmm.
that the people who work, lawyers who worked in the juvenile system, did come from basically a criminal law background where they did, this was not on their plate anywhere. I don't know how to do that. Somebody else needs to do it.
You don't issue a warrant to get everybody in.
Yeah, that's the starting point.
So, but I do like the combination of the development and then that you know, something that accounts for the attorney oversight. Those are my more than 2 cents on the issue. Anything else on attorneys, all attorneys appearing in juvenile court, whether for children and parents or DOJ DA?
Well, and it's, I mean, the caseload standards, I think we have the same. That, does that mirror? I think that mirrors adoption of, because when we wrote that one, I think we tweaked it to mirror, or yeah. No, it did already, adoption of maximum caseload standards. Mm-hmm. We just added DOJ in there because we weren't in there. It was just prosecutors. So we just put in DDAs and AAGs. And then that would mirror the parents and kids of children's attorneys' adoption of maximum caseload standards.
I was just going to see how we wanted to kind of put this together, because I think probably if everybody can update their own section and send it to me, then I can work on compiling it into a cohesive best practices document and send it out to you to take a look at.
Okay. And then I guess the question is, when do we, should we should set some deadlines for
we
those
We should probably
things.
Do that sooner rather than later, I think.
We wanted those in sentence form.
Yeah.
Okay.
What's realistic for everybody to get the edits to Leola?
2 weeks is the 26th?
Yep.
And then do you want to turn around and in a reasonable time and get the edited version back out so that we at least all have it to take another look at?
Before the next meeting. The next meeting
is the 14th of November.
Okay. So maybe I shoot for getting something back to folks by October 14th. And then if we have some legislators at the next meeting, then at least we've all had a chance to look at it. And if you get comments back to me, then we can at least get a draft that people have had a chance to look at out to people to see.
You want us to send it to everyone or just to you?
The edits to the draft that I put together, I think, should go out to everyone.
I mean, what we're doing right now when we're fixing our section and sending it in, and then you're going to compile it.
I think if you, it's up to you guys if you want to see it, but I think if you send it to everyone, for those people who haven't done it yet, it will be a reminder.
Okay.
And people can kind of mirror language.
And then I think what I can commit to doing is Monday getting an email out to everybody about what we said we would do and the deadlines before the next meeting, mostly to remind myself probably, but you know, we have these meetings every so often and everybody gets busy, and I find that I'm scrambling a little bit before the next meeting, so.
Me too.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was asking. Let's have a date certain.
Okay. So we got a lot of work done on that, but we have not yet touched the draft legislation. Does everybody have that most recent copy? That one, the one that has the August 25th update that went out via email.
I had just a couple of little suggestions. The first one, I think, is on page 3. Section 3 under process E. And I think maybe if we took together and put at the front of the sentence, so together, the Judicial Department, the Office of Public Defense Services, DHS Child Welfare, and DOJ will submit an annual report. Because the way it's still worded, it still seems like we have to drive that.
I think that was Judge Sullivan.
Maybe the word together shall go after the word shall. So just list the agencies. The Judicial Department, OPDS, Child Welfare, DOJ shall together submit.
That works
make
too.
Sense?
Thank you. And then in the next section under appropriations, I think that the appropriation for the State Court Administrator's Office is really to the Judicial Department. So the appropriation to the Oregon Judicial Department. And then my only other question was about the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, or an independent evaluator evaluating each county participating in the program. And not, it's C, it's D, I'm sorry, 3D.
I'm sorry.
And I just wasn't sure if we want it to be the Criminal Justice Commission, and was thinking that maybe this is, you know, money that goes to one of the entities, and the entity contracts with a private evaluator, independent evaluator to do it. To me, the Criminal Justice Commission, yeah, they may not have the expertise in this area. And I know it says or, but I was wondering, is there a need to include them at all? Could it just, like, the funding goes to PDSC and PDSC contracts with an independent evaluator to do this?
That works.
Or, you know, why just say, you know, just say the appropriated funding for an independent evaluator, you know, something like that.
Yeah, somebody has to develop the contract, administer the funds, make sure that it happens.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And that may be why CJC, that wasn't our idea, but it may be why CJC was initially inserted, because they're accustomed to doing reviews of programs. They do the drug court programs and others, but maybe the language should be there as appropriated to the CJC for the purposes of contracting with an independent evaluator. You know, I mean, I don't know if they're the right entity to administer it. I just know they have experience doing that. I think they've worked regularly with other entities that do those types of evaluations. But I'm also open to the idea. OPDS doesn't have any administrative staff that ever does this kind of work at this point in time. So would be, what's that?
Who does?
I think other entities might. But
who wrote this? Amy?
That was Bill.
Bill?
I took the initial draft and I put it into, I told Bill I would continue to be the scribe for the group. So I took what he had initially sort of drafted and put it into this format.
The fact he wrote it probably will silence me, but I think these findings are, there are too many of them and they're not strong enough in certain respects, but he's the expert on how to talk to the legislature, so I guess I'll shut up.
And I thought we talked about that a little last time, because I had even written down, like, for the first one, the Legislative Assembly finds that children do not belong in foster care, as really strengthening it rather than that children need a safe and stable home and la-di-da. They don't belong in foster care.
Foster care is a temporary service and, or something to that effect. Some children do belong in foster care for a period of time.
Right. Okay. Yes, I agree with that.
How about a compromise, since you picked that one, which is my first one to pick too, have a right to permanency, which is the issue, and it doesn't badmouth foster care. It just says this is what this is for: permanency, time, you know, timeliness. I don't think that's said in anywhere in here, does it?
First one.
That's what I just did.
Yeah.
But it's all the rest of
that. Well-being and permanency.
I mean, what does that mean? Well-being. What does well-being have to do with it? I just think it should be punchier and stronger and more adversarial. But like I said, I don't know.
Yeah. What and Bill wasn't here at the last meeting when this came up either, so.
So I think permanency is a term of art, and maybe if we really said what we thought that was, that they need a permanent, stable, safe home to be raised in, is really what we're talking about.
Right. Perfect.
And I think safe has to be in here a couple of times where we talk about reducing foster care. I'm more interested in safely reducing foster care, and I think that's different.
Mm-hmm.
So I would want to interject that in F. Moving away from those prematurely in the what the pilot will do. I think measuring outcomes to determine if the youth of foster care has declined as a result of this pilot, I think, is important, because we have so many things going on right now that I think we're going to have evaluators out looking at our differential response. You know, there's going to be lots of evaluations going on, and I think we have to really look to tying the outcomes we're seeking to the activities we're actually doing, not just overall activities occurring.
Like G is such a good one, and I think several of the others could be removed, with G just rising to the top of the, or higher up the list. I mean, that's the point of our legislation, isn't it?
That's another one I'd say are likely to remain safely at home.
Yes, ma'am.
On three, process. When we had originally discussed this concept in this group, we had talked about taking the existing pilot program that OPDS is initiating and then building on that with this concept. When we were in the process of selecting pilot counties, we were meeting with courts and you, and one of the points that was raised when we were selecting our counties was that it was probably important not to pick a DR county because of that issue of not wanting to muddy the waters. And so I'm wondering if under process A, we should actually eliminate the suggestion of specific counties.
Yeah, I think you all have already made the decision to move forward in Lynn and Namhill, and so I don't know why it's not part of this pilot. It's a separate thing. Mm-hmm. And maybe what you need is a comment stating this is expanding a pilot already underway and approved by the legislature.
Well, I think we could just take out A entirely.
So you don't want an iteration in here about the process for selecting the counties for the pilot, this pilot? Who's going to select them?
I suppose you're right that it's the first sentence of A.
And then additional out?
Instead of additional, it would be.
Or we could keep the sentence. I noticed that in the next rollout of DR, it's going into Lynn County, mm-hmm. You know, which we were asked to avoid when we were picking our counties. So I just don't know if it's.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. We'll have to talk about that.
And then whether or not it belongs.
I have honestly been a little confused by this legislation, to be honest. And I, you know, it's, if the work group made this conscious decision, I missed the meeting in which the work group said, yes, we're going to do that. But I don't think I missed that meeting. This is to expand then the program that you already have going. Is that correct? And to get the finances to expand the program you already have going.
My understanding is that we did have a conversation among this work group, and the concept was developed to initiate something together. And we put that in because we thought it was building on what we were initiating. And I thought that was the discussion in the work group. So we have separate.
To expand that.
So it's to bring every. Expand in the sense of formally bringing in other entities, mm-hmm. which I thought was the suggestion that this group had made, and that we were all.
I'm not sure what the problem here is. Why not say that the Legislative Assembly in the X session authorized a, whatever the program is called, to be initiated in Lynn and Yamhill counties, and then proceed on to say that these various entities will choose the additional counties to participate in the program saw here or something like that. I'm not sure what.
Right, I'm just not sure it's relevant anymore. In other words, I'm not sure that the fact that we have the parent-child representation program initiated in Lynn and Yamhill County is relevant to this concept. I mean, I think, so the question I'm having is, do we as a group want to do what I thought the direction we were going in, which was, you know, take this effort that's already been launched and then add the other components. I thought what we had discussed was this idea that we were going to try to create sort of a county with representation for everyone so we have outcomes that we can then demonstrate what happens when every entity is fully represented. So I thought that was the push behind it, and that to be efficient with resources, that the idea was to pull off of what's already been launched. Mm-hmm. So
does anybody disagree with that?
I don't disagree with that. I think I've been a little concerned that this is outside the scope of this work group. And by sitting on this work group as a state agency, I can't take a position on this one way or the other at this point. So I'm really just reflecting off what I see here and commenting. But so I don't actually have an objection to what you're saying. I was just trying to get clarity for when this decision was actually and recommendation was actually made.
I do think that was the confusion we talked about last time, because I hadn't gotten it before the last meeting. I hadn't seen it. I was not aware a legislative concept was being drafted. It was drafted and then crafted by Amy and you guys, and then sent out to everybody for discussion. And that was what we discussed at the last meeting.
That's the one I missed.
It was actually drafted by Bill.
Yeah,
right.
This is just a nicer format of what was drafted.
My point was, Bill didn't send it out to the whole group and say, here's what I've thrown out. Bill sent it to OPDS and said, would you please draft this? Or
he said, what do you think of this? And I think we
sent
it on saying, looks good. Here are the first two counties we've selected.
I think that was, that's the confusion. And similarly, as a state agency, I would have to run any kind of legislation passed way up above me. What it stands for is, there's no objection to what it stands for. It's how it's phrased and whether or not it comes out of a charge from this work group, which is identify changes to existing law that would require the investment and support of additional state funds. So maybe it would say to create a legislative concept. That would be our report due out of this task force. I don't know.
And maybe that's what Bill was doing, was trying to create a legislative concept.
I think he was trying to get something done because of timing issues.
Yeah.
Because we were putting so much effort into all the other steps, and there was sort of a deadline. And my thought, and I hope I'm remembering this correctly, but the concept overall was to try to move something along that was going to produce, hopefully, some tangible results for everyone involved, so that then when you try to go back and say, we need to fully fund all of this work, that this project would have some measurable results to go back with. So that I think in that overarching discussion, he did, put something together.
And I think it was the June 6th meeting where this concept was talked about. We weren't in this room. We were down in one of the hearing rooms on the first floor, A, B, or C, or D, E, F. And of course, I don't have those notes with me, but there was certainly discussion. It wasn't it wasn't something that Bill just
absolutely
initiated without this group having first conceptualized it.
It was the June 6th meeting.
Was it? Okay.
It said that there would be information put together for recommendation for the pilot. and information would be compiled by this group to adopt the pilot
and
project.
My recollection is that this theme came from the very beginning, first meeting of this work group, in which we've been talking about high quality legal representation for parents and kids and for DHS, and we had the people come in from Washington State, and so this is the high quality legal representation of being able to move these cases along and get them resolved expeditiously with kids being safe has been an ongoing theme.
And that's what I would expect a recommendation for this group to be.
Yeah.
My notes say recommendation. It doesn't say statute change.
Yeah,
right.
I think that was just the tweet.
Yeah.
Well, I recall us having conversation about how long it would take to get a bill in and when we would need to have a draft bill, and having legislators come and being invited to this meeting so that hopefully judiciary or some other committee would some legislators would pick up and run with this for this group.
Yeah.
Okay.
In July.
That, it makes sense that it was the timing issue where we are with respect to session. That makes
right.
total sense.
The other thing that I'm concerned about, and it's related to this, and you know, I think this should move forward, but the other thing that I'm concerned about is related to House Bill 4156 from last session and the concept of DHS having full legal representation, and haven't seen anything or heard anything about that. And I don't see it being this or that. I think both of those things need to be moving forward. And
I would say that it is moving forward. We've been meeting with DOJ since for quite a while and submitted our report, which we were required to do, I think this week, the progress we've made towards that goal of, you know, resolving the representation issue that statute creates for us. I did see it separate from this. I mean, I think we had to have conversation with our council around how we could get there and what some options were, and so that's in that report to the legislature.
So can that
There's a
report?
Budget note. It's a public document. They have it.
Can you forward it to us?
I have a question about page 2 under purpose. And this gets back to a conversation we've already been having today. The purpose of this act is to create a juvenile dependency pilot project. That's not true. It has already been created, right?
Right. Well, this is to, I think that the idea here was to create something that built upon, and so one has been created and is underway, and if this bill were to fail or not move forward, clearly, we have our program, and we had funding for it, and we're sticking with it. If this bill were to pass, and if it became a joint collaborative effort, then it would be a different pilot.
Be expanded would be different,
right? Well, I think that you can't. The current name, parent and child representation, wouldn't fit. So this provides a new, different name. So in this, it would be different because it involves all of the entities.
Isn't what you're really talking about is more of a partnership, that this pilot is going to partner with the pilot that you have.
Right.
I mean, I think that's...
Right. And we talked about that in June, and I think my commentary was, it changes what we had initially set out to do, and then I even made a joke about, but Oregon is different, and so we don't necessarily have to replicate exactly what Washington did, you know, forever. We could switch it and have Oregon have its own model, but we have legislatively appropriated funds, and we couldn't just hold on to them and wait for this group to make a decision.
That's
so.
Not going to confuse the members of the legislature. Wouldn't we already do this last session? What is this?
Well, I think we can explain.
I'll defer
it,
to the people who know how to talk to them, but it sounds confusing to me. I'm confused.
And I think the response to that is that the funds and the pilot that PDSC was able to set up was really just focusing on attorneys for parents and children. And what this does is it recognizes the need of not only attorneys for parents and children, but also attorneys for the state and attorneys for DHS and if sufficient judicial resources to handle it.
Right, and that rather than us running two separate programs, we combine it. But
so do you think a sentence in there about the existing program will work in partnership with the pilot program is appropriate, or would that just make it more complicated? So would inserting a sentence under 2A that this pilot program will work in partnership with the existing child parent program or something along those lines?
I'm afraid that might just confuse it
more. Confusion.
For now, we should maybe just be silent on it. But I think the question of whether the draft legislation should specifically call out Lynn and Yamhill as the first counties, I mean, that sentence I'm just not sure about. Although from a resources perspective, for us to be efficient with our resources, it's helpful because that we've already made the shift in that county.
But this does contemplate a different pilot than that, like I think you were pointing out. So. That is a, and I, did you get the appropriation through a bill or just an appropriation for that?
Just an appropriation.
Yeah. Those are different pilots, in my mind, than this contemplates. They're along the same line, but it's a different effort. We don't have full representation in both those counties.
Right, and the idea was to get you full representation. I think when we first started the discussion.
then it is an extension of that, and it should be,
right.
You know, it's either in or out. And if this is a totally separate pilot, then those aren't the first counties. That's a separate effort that you have undergoing. This is a different one. If those are the first counties,
then include them.
Well, or at least nod to that prior effort, because they're going to raise it. Well, aren't we already doing this? We gave you money last time to do this. Aren't we already doing it? So we're going to have something in here that references it for clarity if it's an expansion of the existing pilot.
And Andrew,
so we'll work on that.
Under your existing pilot, are you required to show reporting measures and metrics? No. Because
Yes. No, we yes, we are.
Okay. It's I was not like, phrased. Wow, how did you do that?
Sorry. it doesn't have the same phrasing as this.
No, but I'm
yes,
thinking
we then, are demonstrating results.
And I just may not be aware, but it would seem maybe that you would want those
right.
counties to remain separate so you could show how effective your program is in those counties regardless of if this pilot.
Right.
This pilot would be in a different county to show, look how great everything works when everything is improved. I don't know. I don't know if it would muddy your reporting statistics
right.
if
right.
you did.
I think it's different than what this group had discussed initially,
yeah.
but that's why I raised the question.
Now this work group is saying that we need to expand it in these capacities.
Megan. Thank you. This concept has not been submitted yet to Legislative Council, and so if you have changes you would like to see to it, we need those by the 22nd.
22nd of September.
Very soon.
What was the date?
22nd of September.
To changing finding number one as per Lois's suggested language? I thought we did.
I documented that. I added Lois's suggestion of children need a permit, safe and stable home to be raised, and something to that extent.
Yes.
Phrased a little bit better.
I don't think D, E, and F are necessary. But of all of them, the one that is, I think, shouldn't be in here is E.
Is which one, sorry? E?
E.
Okay.
For a long time, in many different places, it's not in the best interests of any child, not just the kids who, it's the moving around part that's the point of that one. I just feel, as I said before, that G is really the punchy issue here, and that the others are kind of self-evident. I mean, don't people in the legislature know that children suffer when they get moved around and aren't in school and have attachment disorders?
But I'm not sure they understand that children in foster care get moved around.
Oh.
They don't?
Well,
we submit a report every session about that.
I know.
That.
They should know that, but I'm just... I mean, and that may have been Bill's point in this, is to sort of remind them of what the pitfalls of foster care are.
So what I would prefer is, instead of enumerating all the horrors of foster care, that we put something in here that says, you know, that the Oregon legislature, you know, finds that foster care is a temporary service and is less effective the more prolonged it is, or something to that effect. Because really that's...
Yeah.
It's a service for kids. It's not a where you go and stay. It's very effective in certain instances when you need a safe environment, but the longer it goes on, the less effective it is. So.
I think that's a great language to have in here.
Okay.
What did you say?
Write that down.
Foster
it's an excellent,
care
you know, it's foster care is a necessary and effective service that is less effective the more prolonged it becomes, or something to that effect, or is a necessary and effective service that is intended to be short-term until a child can be returned to a more permanent placement, or until a more permanent placement can be made, something to that. And I can play with that and send, or is Amy going to be the recipient of these edits?
I can continue to do,
okay.
I told Bill I would do that. I can continue to do that if that would be helpful for you. I don't mind.
And so you'll work with Lois?
I will work with Lois. Well, I will try to incorporate your language, Lois. And
okay, yeah,
and
I'll work with Amy.
Yeah, get it out there.
I'm just curious about process and how we're going to get all these thoughts and edits done when they need to be.
Do any of you use Google Documents? I'm happy to put this up on the Google Drive and open it to you for editing. It's kind of a collaborative group editing environment.
I can email on this.
Okay.
My 14-year-old can show me how to do Google Documents to edit.
It's really simple.
You
might try that.
So, Amy, you're going to revise the legislative piece and send it to folks.
I can do that. So we need to have,
your process.
Though,
the 22nd is next Monday.
That's why That's why Bill got distracted.
It's Monday.
Not this Monday, the following Monday.
Okay, good.
We have more than 2 days.
One week.
I do think my concern with Google Docs is that we have this week-long timeline, and it may take something more. Like, if we can get it, if Amy can get the edits done today.
My boss has informed me I will get the edits today. I will have the edits done today.
So I don't know.
You have nothing else to do, right?
I don't know.
Yeah. I'll be happy to do it. I'll get them out today, and then if I can hear back, if everybody can respond back by, say, Wednesday morning, is that sufficient for me to compile one final draft?
I wasn't going to say get them out today. I was going to say work on them today and then get them out next week.
Well, here's the issue. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of next week, there's a big event happening. So if
I don't know.
You don't know anything, you're on vacation, right? So
I'm on vacation.
For me, it's going to be difficult if I get these on Monday and I have to have them back to you by Wednesday morning. That's going to be hard.
And I'm not going to look at them or do anything with them until Thursday or Friday at the earliest.
Right.
So
it, can you get them to us today? You know, weekends are so free.
Of course I can get them to you today. No problem.
If you can, that would be great. And then the Wednesday deadline is more doable.
Or Friday. If we just make Friday the I'm out also.
That's
next
fine.
Week. So it might be hard.
Let me let you all know what my schedule is going to be, because you're not going to see anything from me for a while. I'm going to be out of the country for the next, I'll be tomorrow morning, and I won't be back till the 30th. I'll be in and out of the office the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, so you can reach me. Those are the days to do it. And then I'm having surgery on the 6th of October, and I'll probably be off of work the entire of the month. And you'll know when hopefully I'll be in the hospital for a week, and then I'll be at home, and I'll be back online again. If you don't get any kind of responses or anything from me, don't worry about it. It just means I'm not up and, losing at that point. Yeah, so.
Good planning, though, to go on vacation first, Judge.
Right. Well, yeah, that was planned before this all happened, so.
So if
I will hopefully be able to attend the meeting on the 14th. I'm certainly expecting to be back at work by the 1st of the month and be able to travel and come over to the meeting on the 14th. So I should be definitely back by then.
So then I guess the question is setting a time when we can expect to get today's vert edits and then when we all have to get it back.
So it sounds like I can do that when I get back to the office, so I can get them out, say, by 2-ish this afternoon. I get a thumbs
say
up.
Say 3, you're allowed to have lunch.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Take care.
I will do my best. And then if I can get them back, it sounds like the 19th is realistic. I can compile them next Friday and get at least a draft to Shauna for Monday. My only concern is that that's not going to allow this group to review the kind of the second rev of the draft.
But you'll have an opportunity to revise the LC in the meantime. Yeah. So what we need to get it in, what comes back can be revised.
So do you want it first, like by 8 or 9 on the 19th, like a time that you want it by? That's probably best.
That is probably best. Yes. 8 or 9 on the 19th. I'll put it in my email that I send out.
Okay.
Well, and I think because of the quick turnaround, if responses for edits go to everybody and not just Amy, that then you'd at least know what other people are saying and what she's going to be putting together.
Okay. Can I give you one other correction?
Yes, of course.
We actually generally receive the appropriation for whatever needed legal services we need. So if you would change that from the Department of Justice to the Department of Human Services, then we can use that appropriation to purchase their services.
Thank you for typing quickly this afternoon.
My pleasure. Like I said, I told Bill I would be happy to be the scribe.
Anything else before we sign off? Okay, so we'll get that today, and then I'm in this weekend, I will send an email out to everybody about what we said we committed to. And again, that's partly for me to remember what I said I'd do. And the next meeting is on the 14th. Anything else before we?
November.
Next meeting is November 14th.
Uh-huh. So do we want to re-invite Justice Brewer to that meeting to give him a heads up on everything that's happening here and
you
some
think
legislators?
That's a good idea?
I think he's certainly very interested in attorney representation across the board in juvenile cases. And the legislative piece, if we want to have some legislators here.
I think that would be appropriate. I think with all the work that we did on the best practices discussion today, we're much more prepared to actually have somebody here instead of trying to flesh things out, which is what we spent the majority of the meeting doing today.
I think my only comment would be maybe we should have our November meeting to make sure everything is as we intend it to be. I feel like a little nervous that maybe we aren't quite there yet with a unified vision, and I would hate to have a legislator present if we aren't all on the same page. And so it might be helpful to have, maybe we even want to schedule an October meeting so that we have a chance to look at the final drafts as submitted and look at the final best practices, even if it's a shorter meeting, even if it's a teleconference. It might be good for this group to have an opportunity to convene before November legislators.
What if, when we talk about getting the best practices document finished, that we were going to send edits in by the 26th of September and Leola was going to get it back to us the 14th of October. I wonder if that right around that date, 14th or 15th, would be a good time for us to check in about do we need to schedule something before the next meeting, or are we comfortable proceeding with invitations? We could figure that out via email.
One other thing we could do is we could
hold a time.
You're
more organized than I am.
At least a conference call time.
Hold the 13th as a time to touch base.
October 13th?
October 13th.
That's
at 9.
Friday.
It's a Friday, so it's still.
I'll be out of the country. Then.
October 13th is a Monday.
That's the ICWA conference.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking at. You're right. I'm looking at.
It's the day before the ICWA conference.
October 17th.
I'm not available in the morning that day.
Oh.
Can do it.
October 24th? Oh, I'm not available that day. Wait a minute. I would be fine on the 24th.
The 24th?
Yeah.
Does the 24th work for everybody?
I'm not available.
Oh, you're not. That's fine.
Halloween.
Is that enough time to get legislators on board? I guess it's enough time to call them off.
Well, we're holding a time to have a meeting of this group, and then the November 14th meeting would be when the legislators were present.
Right, and so I'm just questioning, if we met on the 31st, is 2 weeks enough time to extend an invitation, or would we need to extend the invitations, and then on the 31st, if we find that we're not...
extend the invitation, and then if we need to cancel,
withdraw.
Do that. That would fit easier on their schedules then.
Okay.
So the 31st we want to hold for a time?
Is that at 9 a.m.?
I'll be out of the country, but I can have someone sub in for me.
What is all this out of the country stuff? What is going on?
I know.
Canadian Thanksgiving when I'm gone. My husband's Canadian, so we have to go up there Monday the 18th or
16th
or whatever.
So October 31st, are we just planning on a conference call?
I think that would be all we would need, wouldn't we?
I think so.
Megan, are you available on the 31st?
Yes, I'm available.
Okay.
Is this a 9? I did already ask. Is this a 9 a.m.?
Yeah.
Okay.
Works for me.
All right. Anything else?
9 o'clock conference call.
Yes.
You can have it.
And you're going to send out all the dates.
I am.
Thank you.
And I reminded, I put a note to myself, I actually had to do that. So, yes. Okay. I think we're done. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye, Megan.
Bye.